Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Hi, I am Elena Caldwell, and I am from Seattle, Washington, from the Central.
I'm Jasmine Jackson, and I'm from the Central District of Seattle, Washington.
I'm Eula Scott Bino, and I am from the cultural capital of Seattle, the Central District.
So we have some guests on the show today on Sound Effect, and all of you women in the room right now, you are the creators of a podcast. What is the name of the podcast that you make?
Hello Black, Hella Seattle.
Can you all say it together?
Yeah.
Hello Black, Hella Seattle.
And what is Hella Black, Hella Seattle about?
So for us, being Hella Black and Hella Seattle is who we are naturally. When we wake up in the morning, we wake up as Black women, and we very much identify as being Seattleites. And so it's a show that, from our perspective, is meant to reach listeners that relate to us and both of those fronts ideally. And if not, then hopefully they get to know us and figure out where we do connect.
If someone has never heard of Hella Black, Hella Seattle before, what can they find on your show?
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything that you would probably need to get an idea of what Seattle is, of places to go in Seattle, of food to eat in Seattle, and people that make up the community, basically.
And you kind of asked to take over this episode of Sound Effect.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So we got this great notice in our email where you guys were reaching out for people to, you know, come up with ideas for episodes. And from our perspective, Seattle is acknowledging of its Black history to a degree. I think people are constantly talking about the gentrification that's happened in the Central District and trying to figure out, you know, how do we go back in time or how do we correct those mistakes? And it's more about, for us, kind of honoring our history. And Black History Month is just like, it's right there for us. It's open for the picking, and it's a really good time to explore what we have right here in our backyard.
And so what exactly does Black History Month mean to all of you?
Yeah.
I think it's easily overlooked, but I think it's a time to really, like, take ownership of what it means to be Black, of
the plight.
The plight, but also just how we've contributed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, how we've contributed to everything that has happened in America, basically, and all around, but still, you know.
Yeah, I mean, well, one, Black people have made a gigantic impact on this country alone. And when you go to school, it's not included in the history books at all. Mm-hmm. There's a really small segment where they talk about Martin Luther King and about the civil rights movement, but it's not addressed how slavery was impactful. And then after slavery, a lot of Black people went right into society and made an impression very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of nice to have these moments to look back, and especially us as three young Black women interviewing three adult Black women, older mm-hmm. Black women, and letting us see how great, you know, we can be.
And on a local level, that's what the show mm-hmm. is about. Yeah. You're going to be celebrating Black history
totally
in the Seattle area.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And growing up in Seattle, according to the 2010 census, Seattle is nearly 70% white. I don't know what the current stats are today. Did you feel that as a kid growing up here?
Yes and no.
Not as much as we do now.
Yeah, I think you definitely feel it more now because so many people have moved out of the Central, and so that's where we grew up. So, you know, being able to go outside and see Black people, it felt like there was more of them because it was more concentrated.
Right.
But if you kind of stepped outside of that zone, definitely you were able to understand that, like, white is out there. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But it's different today.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were so many more restaurants, venues, people of color owned houses, owned property in the Central District. It's just not there anymore now.
Yeah.
It's different now, too.
So who are we going to hear from? Who are the voices we're going to hear on the show?
I interviewed Dee Charlene. So she owns a salon and beauty college in the Central District. She's been there for over 50 years. She's still hanging on. She's a wonderful woman. She has some crazy stories.
Yeah. And I'll be interviewing Pastor Pat Wright, who is the leader of the Experience Gospel Choir. And, I mean, she has a voice that is just out of this world. She performed with her choir at Jimi Hendrix's funeral. And so she has, like, such an amazing legacy. And it's just going to be fantastic to hear all of her life story.
Mm-hmm. And then I, Elena, am going to be interviewing Christy Brown from That Brown Girl Cooks. So she's had a catering company. She makes black eyed peas hummus, which is like amazing. And just like overall a vibrant personality that's been in the black community for years.
So today on the show, we are teaming up with these women behind the Hella Black, Hella Seattle podcast to tell stories of black history here in the Northwest, stories you can only find on Sound Effect. Stick around. Seattle's Total Experience Gospel Choir performs for presidents. It travels all over the world, and its founder is Pastor Pat Wright. She's also the choir's director. Now, Pastor Wright has done other things. She's been a DJ. She's recorded R&B songs. But she's best known for her work with the choir, which has been around for 43 years. Hella Black, Hella Seattle's Eula Scott Bino talked with Pastor Wright in our Seattle studios about how the choir got started, its importance to her, and when Pastor Wright first knew she could sing.
I was 3 years old, and I was singing around the house, and my father was the pastor of the church, mm-hmm. and my mother was a school teacher. And out of the eight kids, they heard me just singing everything at age three. In the kitchen, outdoors, playing, whatever I was doing, I was always singing. And that's how my father said one Sunday morning in church, he said, "My baby has something to do for you." And so you want me to imitate it?
Yeah.
Okay, here I am, 3 years old, right?
Okay.
"I don't want to sing, Daddy." He said, "Come on, baby, do it for Daddy." "Okay. Jesus love me, this I know." And that's how it started.
Yeah. Can you describe the Total Experience Gospel Choir for me, how it came to be and, you know, how it's formed into what it is today?
It started out as a high school choir at Franklin High School back in 1973. I had been teaching there for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Music.
Oh,
and
wow.
I don't read music. I know nothing. I can't read music at all.
Oh, wow.
No.
How do you move everything around
and
arrange it?
It's just a natural gift.
Yeah.
So the black kids were not going to the Bel Canto Choir. They just refused to get in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when they called me. Somebody had heard me on the radio talking about gospel music, and they asked me to come in and interview.
Right.
And I did, and the principal then mm-hmm. said to me, "I don't care what they say. I want you to work here."
Yeah.
And so when we started the choir class in 1972, I couldn't take all the kids who wanted to get in the choir.
Mm-hmm.
And we had over 100 black kids trying to get in that choir room, which only had 60 kids.
Yeah.
And I said to them, "I'm sorry, we just can't take everybody." And at that point, I was going to Mount Zion Baptist Church here in Seattle,
mm-hmm.
right on the corner of 19th and Madison.
Right.
And I talked to Reverend McKinney, who was the pastor then. And I said to him, "May I bring our choir rehearsals to the church, because the church is big enough to handle all the kids who are interested?"
Right.
He said, "Yeah, bring them on.
Yeah.
So I ended up with 112 kids the very first night.
Oh my gosh. Were they all from Franklin? I imagine everybody from Garfield
spread.
Heard by then.
Oh, the word spread all over the place. And
yeah.
I all these kids. I said, "Oh my God, what am I going to do with all these kids?
Right.
I need help."
Yeah.
So I called up my good friend Jessica Howard and my friend Susie Brooks, and I said, "Come help me with these kids." And Robert Stevens, who worked in the school system as well, and he came, and they were our first chaperones.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
How many people are in your choir today?
26.
Wow. What has been able to keep its longevity going and keep it up for this long?
The Total Experience Choir is not supposed to still be together.
Why?
We were ostracized and criticized because the young people wouldn't sing in their church choirs.
Mm-hmm.
But I had them lined up waiting to get into Total Experience.
What do you think the difference was?
Because I didn't preach to them. They
right.
came in to do the music. Plus, I choreographed all of our music.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids loved that.
I imagine it was such like up-tempo and fun.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Yeah.
They don't know that heavy stuff. They're kids.
Right.
That's
yeah.
the problem with churches right now. You can't make old folks out of young people.
Right.
You have your music director has to find music that they can identify with.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like it, if it wasn't for you saying, let's keep it going, it wouldn't have survived.
No, it wouldn't have succeeded.
Yeah. And do you feel like there's a plus to you not having a like stagnant church or a stagnant school because you're able to?
Well, I'm glad I'm out of the schools, to tell you the truth, because we had so many parents who were complaining because it was gospel music. Mm-hmm. But they should have let their kids stay in because they probably, some of them would probably be still living today.
Right. Right.
Because they got into a lot of junk out there.
Yeah.
And I stress education, mm-hmm. especially for African American children. I beat it in them.
Right.
No, you can't make it without some kind of piece of paper, okay? And I don't mean a piece of paper to say you just got out of jail.
Yeah.
And many of them have gone on to become great. And the two kids that I have, my son is ours. My daughter I adopted out of the Total Experience Choir at age 14.
Oh, wow.
I took her to her foster parents' home as I dropped kids off after rehearsal. And they wouldn't let her in. And I said to her, get back in this van, mm-hmm. and you'll never have to go there again unless you want to.
Right.
And so she never went back.
Yeah.
And now I'm so proud of her.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And there's so many stories like that. We've already been to 28 countries in 33 states.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. You know, it's a trip, too, because I think about how, you know, when you have a calling to something like, you know, to ministry or to music, mm-hmm. it can be hard to make a living doing it, I imagine.
Oh, you don't make it doing gospel.
Yeah, but you have.
I've never made any money singing gospel music. I made my money when I was singing music. It was all R&B.
Right.
I have my little 45 went to the top of the chart here.
What? Yeah. What was the song?
Ooh, I let a good man go.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah. And it's Patronelle Staten. I used my maiden name at that point.
Okay. I read somewhere, too, that you performed at Jimi Hendrix's funeral.
I was the one who performed for him. When he passed away, this family got in touch with me right away.
Yeah.
And asked me if I would sing. I knew his mom.
Oh, that's too good.
Right.
That's beautiful.
And I've sang for three presidents myself, the national anthem.
That's amazing. Did you meet Obama?
Yeah, I did.
What was that like?
Uh-oh.
Were you giddy?
Like a little kid.
Oh, I could only imagine. Was he smooth?
Oh, it's a baby's booty. Yeah, when he came to Seattle, we did the anthem for him.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you did the Black National Anthem?
We did both of the anthems.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you sing some of the Black National Anthem?
Sure. Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Let it ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the listening skies, mm-hmm. then let it resound loud as the rolling sea.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, I appreciate you. What does this choir mean to you?
They're my children. And although the makeup of the choir has changed completely, I was all these black children. Mm-hmm. And now it's all white adults, with
yeah.
the exception of four.
Yeah. But do you relate to them the same way? Does it feel the
same? I do. They tell me, well, sometimes you talk just like real children. I say, you don't like it? And they'll say, well, yeah, I like it.
It's nice to have guidance. It's nice to have somebody looking out for you and telling you what to do.
Yeah, well, it's not your culture.
Right.
And so I have to teach you how to feel it, the yeah. music, and have to make that and own that music for yourself. Mm-hmm. I said, just imagine that if I'm singing a song called Precious Lord, which is Thomas A. Dorsey's number one hit and is still most requested funeral hymn
right.
that we do.
Leave me, oh,
I said, picture yourself losing one of your children. Mm-hmm. And somebody gets up and starts doing hip hop or something.
Yeah.
No, that's no comfort.
Yeah.
I said, but the words to Precious Lord will help you to accept, although you'll never, ever get over it.
Yeah.
But accept the fact that this person is, the opportunity to see this person again mm-hmm. is very real.
Right.
And this song will teach you how.
Yeah.
This gentleman who was pretty well off came and joined, and he was a history teacher. mm-hmm. So he knew all the history of the music, so he thought. And I said to him, you ever been to a black funeral? He said, no. I said, then you don't know the history. He said, what does that mean? I said, next time somebody passes away, one of the elders, I'm going to tell you, come go with me. Then you'll understand black history. And so after the funeral was over, he said to me, I went to school today.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yes, you did.
Everything that you've talked about today has really led you to singing and teaching. Do you think that you could live a life where you weren't doing one or the other?
No.
Wouldn't
I
work.
Don't. I, and this may sound a little bit morbid, but I can see myself passing away singing and catapulted.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be sad when I leave.
No, you're going home.
Yeah, I'm going home.
Yeah. That's good. You're going to go up there and sing and teach?
Yeah, I'm gonna show the angels how to do the electric slide.
Sounds like a good time.
That was Eula Scott Bino talking with Pastor Pat Wright. Eula, can you read this last bit for me?
Absolutely. Still ahead, the self-proclaimed best hairstylist in Seattle.
My business is my dream. Yes. And that's why I tell people to plan their work and work their plan.
We're telling stories of Seattle's Black history today on Sound Effect.
You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and if you're just joining us, today we're teaming up with the women of the Hella Black, Hella Seattle podcast to tell stories of Black history in the Northwest. And up next is food. Elena Caldwell reviews new restaurants for the podcast, and she's a bit of a foodie. She finds a kindred spirit in Christy Brown. Christy moved to Seattle from Kansas City as a teen in the 80s, and here she fell in love with the Northwest culinary scene, its diversity and the variety that's on display at any of the area's farmers markets. Christy is a chef and a caterer. She's worked at a lot of top local Black-run restaurants, including the iconic Kingfish Cafe. It was a high-end soul food restaurant on Capitol Hill, and it closed in 2015. Elena and Christy sat down at Christy's home in South Seattle and talked about how she first decided to be a chef.
My dad and mother were teachers, and they just were really, like, you had to go to college. That it was no exception. That was just the deal. And my oldest brother got into, he was in college, and he was in his senior year and decided that he loved music so much that he wanted to change his major. Well, at the time, he was an accounting major. And so he did it. He changed his major, and my dad was livid because mm-hmm. that meant he wasn't going to graduate on time. And I think my dad was just in this space. And so he came back home after talking to him and was like, you know what? Go to the library and figure out what you want to do with your life. And I was like, but I'm 13. Like, I, you know, I'm just a kid. Mm-hmm. Like, so I was super mad. I was super mad and I stomped down to the library and went up to the library and I was like, I'm supposed to figure out what I'm supposed to do in my future. Where do I go? So she took me to the card catalog and we went through and she said, okay, well, what do you like to do? And I said, well, I like to eat, you know, I like to kick it with my friends. I like to cook sometimes. And she was like, oh, so you want to go into hospitality? And I was like, huh, oh, okay. Yeah. So she was like, what do you watch on TV? And I was like, Hotel. So Hotel was this show with Sherry Belafonte. And it was like the only serious show on TV with a black woman in it. Mm. And so I was super excited. I went to work in hotels. And so I came home and I was like, I want to be a chef. And as an educated black family, they weren't exactly happy about their daughter wanting to be in the service industry. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think that thankfully for my brother's mess up, that they wanted me to be happy mm-hmm. and they wanted me to do something that I was going to commit to doing. Mm-hmm. So I don't think at that point they cared. So that's really how it started, or officially how it started. But I have a menu that I was 5 years old, and I used to write, like, I'm going to make this for the first course and for the second course. So that's my thing to let me know. I mean, first of all, I'm a big believer in working in your purpose. Mm-hmm. That really is the only answer that you have if you want to be happy. Mm-hmm. So I knew that it was just a divine reminder mm-hmm. that that's what I was supposed to be doing.
So where did you start at? I heard Kingfish. Is that really where you started?
Yeah. No, I worked at a store. It was called the Corner Store, and it was at the Bond. So before Macy's, that building was built for the Bond Marché. Mm-hmm. My boss was Edwina, and she was just amazing. And I told her that I was coming in for the cashier hostess position, but I was going to go work in the kitchen after that. And she was like, yeah, you don't want to do that. But I kept asking, and so she was like, okay, I'll give you a try. And she did, and I loved it. I got to learn how to make breakfast, which if you're going to learn how to cook just straight out of a restaurant, that's the best time because it's the fastest time. Mm. You have to be on your toes and know what you're doing because people don't want over medium eggs if they ask for over easy, mm-hmm. you know, so yeah.
So now tell me about Kingfish.
Da-ha-ha-ha.
Well, Kingfish was beautiful, by the way. I just feel like I need to say that.
It was an amazing experience to be in a place with, at the time, it was all the three sisters and the chef and I, and we had the crew, Cherry, our dishwasher. She was good. Like, so it was just like all these powerful black women mm-hmm. doing this amazing thing around presenting our food in a light that didn't downplay it and make it seem like it was, oh, you know, just go around the corner and get you some such and such. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like that. And it was a really excellent experience. And I feel like, you know, there just wasn't a lot of people doing that. Mm-hmm. Definitely not in Seattle. I mean, no shade to Miss Helens mm-hmm. or any of the people that had come before them. It just was a different level mm-hmm. of service. And so it was just an amazing opportunity to do that kind of work with women, mm-hmm. you know. And
that sounds empowering.
Yeah, I didn't really, I think I'm still like understanding the power of mm-hmm. that now. Yeah.
That's how it goes sometimes.
Oh, for sure. I think that's for everything. Mm-hmm. You get the understanding that you can't get at that time. Mm-hmm. And as you grow, you're like, oh, okay. You know, it's all about perspective.
Yeah. So for the podcast, I do the food reviews. Mm-hmm. So I'm all about food. So I have to just ask you, around that time, was there like a favorite place to go?
I'm so funny about food. Like my favorite place, like I would say, where do I go more often than any place right now? Mm-hmm. It's the Pho Bach on Rainier over by Cloverdale. Like mm-hmm. I love Asian mm-hmm. food. So like I'm just like, oh, okay, let me try this or let me try that. So I don't know.
What is your attraction to Asian food? I know I like Asian food because I don't really eat dairy.
I think that it just started with my dad. Like when we first moved here, like we have farmers markets in Kansas City, but not like the markets here. And we came and down in downtown Renton, there was this like just Asian market and just had all these vegetables. And we always like ate a lot of vegetables growing up. Mm-hmm. And so my dad went crazy. He went cuckoo bears and he just started buying stuff that we didn't know. Mm-hmm. We ate so many bamboo shoots. I just started eating bamboo shoots again. Oh my good Lord, man. But just all kind of crazy things that we didn't know. They were crazy because we just didn't know, yeah. right? And then I just loved it.
So what would be your advice for young Black women today trying to get into the culinary business or a business in general?
I think the one of the bigger things that I always encourage people to do is ask questions. I love it when people call me and say, hey, I'm new to this, or I'm interested in taking this different direction. What do you think? Do you have a moment? And I'm always willing to do it just because I know how important it is. I think definitely building a network, mm-hmm. because this industry is brutal for everybody. Physically, you know, you have a high rate of divorce, high rates of alcoholism, mm-hmm. and drug addiction. People that can't make it in other industries are always looking to the food industry as a backup. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting space to be in, a lot of crazy folks. And you need to know what your level of crazy is, and you need to build a community around it so that you can be able to sustain yourself. That's just huge, and never stop learning.
That was Elena Caldwell with the Hella Black, Hella Seattle podcast, talking with local chef Christy Brown. Christy's own cooking community includes her son. And together, they have a line of local food products called That Brown Girl Cooks, including Christy's infamous black-eyed pea hummus. This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX, and I'm your host, Jennifer Wing. Today, we are handing over the show to the women of Hella Black, Hella Seattle. It's a podcast that if you haven't checked out yet, you should. It shines a light on people of color in the Seattle area, and people the ladies of Hella Black, Hella Seattle say we should know. And that's what we're doing on the show today, introducing you to some of the individuals who are a part of the rich fabric of the Black community and history here in the Northwest. One of them is D. Charlene Williams. She's 73 years old. She owns a salon on Madison Avenue, where Seattle's First Hill neighborhood and the Central District meet. And she's been here for decades. Today, the small Black-owned businesses around her are being replaced by new apartments. D. Charlene says her salon on the corner of 21st and Madison is not going anywhere. Hella Black, Hella Seattle co-host Jasmine Jackson takes us inside.
We're in D. Charlene's salon, and it is absolutely like being in a time capsule all the way back to the 60s. It's amazing. It's like a museum. There are beautiful hats that she's designed. There are furs. There are tons of different plaques and pictures. There's one that says, this is to certify that the NAACP has successfully enrolled or more new members in the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in the 1975 campaign. I mean, it's so awesome. So we're going to go sit down and talk to D. Charlene about hair, politics, and the Central District. I actually grew up around the corner from here on 20th and Denny. Mm-hmm. I remember when Dino's was here and Madison Plaza and Planned Parenthood was over here and Chester Dorsey's. You were the first woman that ever did my hair.
Mm-hmm. Is that good?
Yes, it was amazing. You did when I was 7. It was over 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. I had these big, beautiful, bouncy curls, and I always admired you, D. Charlene.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've been here for 48 years.
That's amazing.
And I love my work. I love hairdressing. Yes. I've always wanted to be a hairdresser, and I loved it. I love it from age 4.
Yeah.
So I always wanted to be a hairdresser and a dress designer.
Yes.
So this is my dream. My business is my dream. Yes. And that's why I tell people to plan their work and work their plan. And you put it out on paper so you see what you want to do. It's like a roadmap for yourself. Mm-hmm. And I've been in business for 55 years.
So it has not always been easy for D. Charlene having her salon in that location. You know, today developers like to get a hold of her property, but crime has also been a problem for her over the years. People have tried to break in every way possible, either to steal or by accident. The beauty shop is on a corner and cars have crashed into the front.
Yeah, I've been through a lot here. I used to have glass doors. Remember the glass doors?
Yes.
I used to
have? Mm-hmm.
They ran a car through here.
Oh my gosh.
And broke all my glass doors out, and I had to have these doors special made, hollow core doors. Heavy, they're double to keep them
wow.
out of here. big heavy doors. That's why they're heavy, to keep them out. They used to chop holes in my roof.
Wow.
And I've been through a lot here on this corner.
Yeah. What has kept you here?
God.
Yeah.
You see, God gave me this building, mm-hmm. told me to keep it, and he wanted me to be an image, an icon for the people.
Absolutely.
And show them how to do a successful business, and he wanted me to be able to help people. And then they had a lot of young girls on the street, and they were prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted them off the streets to be women, feminine women, no prostitutes.
Yes.
And that's my motto is, I dream to make all women beautiful. And that's what I'm talking about, in their heart and out.
Yes.
I dream to do that for them,
yes.
and show them how. And the reason why they were out there, because there was no jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they had little education.
No.
And I wanted them off their knees. I wanted them off their knees.
Dee Charlene ended up teaching a lot of those prostitutes how to do hair and earn a proper living. Back when crime was more of a problem in the neighborhood, Dee Charlene was ready for anyone who tried to attack her.
I used to carry two big guns back in the day. 38 and a long nose and a 38 snub nose. I used to carry those back in the day. And I carried them for protection because this was a dangerous area. This was like the drug capital of the world at the time. It was a dangerous area. And I used to run into trouble with guys trying to pull me, make me a prostitute, or trying to kidnap me. So I just carried my two guns.
One time a man was following her in a car. She had two guns, and the closest place and the safest place she could go to for help was a Seattle Post Intelligencer.
You don't know why everybody's after you.
Right.
And see, and I was married at the time. I was getting rid of my husband, and he had put a crew of people on me because mm-hmm. he's the type that he can quit you, but you can't quit him. Mm-hmm. He was an older man, and I found out he was a gambler, and he wasn't the man I thought he was. He's supposed to have been a rich man with money. He didn't have anything. He was after what I had. And I found all that out. So he had these crew of people on me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started off from work and from my house, and then I hit the freeway. Somebody was following me. I hit the freeway, and then I jumped out of my car, and then that person was following me, and I ran into the PI. Asked for help, and I got stammered and started studying, and I just started shooting.
Wow.
And everybody called for them to call the police, and they did. And this one policeman, he came and arrested me, and he said that he had dreamed about me the night before, and I had dreamed about him, saw him in my dream. He had blonde hair like mine, curly, and he held out his hand for me to come to him. He was a born-again Christian. And I went to him, and he told me, you come with me. He said, you look real classy. What's going on here? He said, I'm going to help you. He said, stay right with me. He said, I'm going to protect you. And he did that.
Dee Charlene ran for city council. She created the Central Area Chamber of Commerce, and she played a role in creating Medic One. The program was the first in the country that trained firefighters and paramedics to provide care like doctors in the field. Dee Charlene did the hair of the doctor's wives who were starting Medic One. She loved the idea, so she organized a fundraiser fashion show at the University of Washington.
And so my girls, we came out with body jewelry. They had body jewelry, and I had them with thin net stockings on and body jewelry all over them, sent them out. And we was at the hub over here at the University of Washington. And the white people were shocked because they'd never seen that, all black models.
Yes.
Black modeling troop, all black modeling. They were shocked. Sharp as a tack.
Mm-hmm.
And I told all the guys, I says, okay, now, fellas, get your checkbooks out and write us some real money. We're trying to get this project into work. And they said, great. And they just looked and said, yeah, how much should you, I said, what you can afford and what you cannot afford.
Right.
Put it down there. And they wrote it out, and we got the first wagon started.
What do you love about your work, and what do you love about doing hair?
I love it all. And I just love making my dream, like I told you, is make all women beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to look at the hair and see what the person needs and grow her hair. And that's how I stay there and take good care of it. And I don't take risks with the hair. And I love it. I love my work because I meet new people. I meet new, exciting people that come into my salon. New, exciting people.
Mm-hmm.
And they have something to offer. And they appreciate the work you do, and they say, oh, you did this, you did that. Oh, I'm so beautiful, I'm this and that. And then they see you years later, and they, oh, you remember when you did this for me, did that? Oh, I love it. See, and that makes me feel good.
Dee Charlene doesn't have any plans to retire soon, and she doesn't plan on selling her building. I think Dee Charlene has an amazing story. I don't know if she knows how amazing and how empowering her story could be for so many people. And I think that's what surprised me the most. I think she needs to write a book. I think that more people need to hear her story, even talking about, you know, the future of the salon and if she has plans to give it to a museum. I mean, it's like being in a time capsule in there. I think that she has so much to give back to the community, and I hope that she knows that she's an amazing, empowering woman.
That was Jasmine Jackson talking with Dee Charlene Williams. You're tuned to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today we've teamed up with the women of the Hella Black, Hella Seattle podcast for a special Black History Month episode of Sound Effect. And this next story is about a husband and wife who worked to make it easier for students of color here in Seattle. The year was 1952. Marion West and her husband, Ray, met when they were students at the University of Washington. Ray, an African-American born and raised in Mississippi, and Marion, a white woman raised on a farm in Sumas, Washington. They were an unlikely pair. Interracial couples were very uncommon back then. Students of color had a difficult time finding housing close to the university, so the Wests decided to meet this need. They bought a 16-room old mansion right in the middle of Fraternity Row, just steps from UW's main campus, a place where students, no matter the color of their skin, could rent a room. And just a heads up, there's a racial slur mentioned in the story that some may find upsetting. Again, the Wests, they bought the house, but it was Marion who had to make the purchase.
Well, it was restricted area at that time, and blacks couldn't buy in that area. And I knew at that time that it was very difficult for non-Caucasians to find housing near the university, and that was very important because more and more were going there.
Word began to spread among friends and fellow students of color that there was a house close to campus that would not turn them away. The house was much more than shelter in a convenient location. In the large living room next to the fireplace, politics were discussed and debated, ideas were shared. There, among the fraternities and sororities, Marion and Ray threw lots of parties that were a little more highbrow than the ones their neighbors put on.
Well, I would say very intellectual, but it sounds very egotistic too. But it was. It was kind of an intellectual center right in the middle of Greek Row. And, of course, the interracial aspect was very much a part of that.
Not only were there African Americans renting rooms, people from all over the world called the old mansion home. Students from China, Korea, Iraq, countries in Africa. During all of this, Marion and Ray were starting a family. They had three young children, a boy and two girls. Their daughter, Kathleen West, the middle child, spent the first few years of her life in this international salon of sorts. Her early impression of the world was that everyone looked different and often sounded different, too.
I recall standing in a little hallway and looking into the kitchen and seeing people who I wasn't sure they were Asian, but they had long braids and thongs and traditional clothing, and they were cooking and talking in a language I didn't understand. And I remember just looking at them and listening and trying to figure out what they were saying. I remember a man who, where was he from, Baghdad? And he came down the stairs and told me to shut my eyes, and he told me to open my eyes, and I saw these beautiful silk slippers. They were red with embroidery on them. I remember an African man teaching me to brush my teeth. I liked to watch him brush his teeth because his toothpaste foamed and foamed. It was really rather glorious because there was so much flavor in all of the different languages and clothing styles and everything. It was very harmonious a lot of the time.
all these people playing with you, giving you gifts, speaking these exotic languages. Did you know if they had gone to another house and asked for a room to rent, they probably would have been turned down?
When I was younger, a little child, I didn't know it was a safe haven. I just knew that my world consisted of people that spoke different languages, wore different kinds of clothing, had different hairstyles, and were very intellectual, but I didn't really know about the outside world.
Were you aware of your parents being different colors and the fact that you guys were biracial?
No, I wasn't aware that they were different from each other at all. It just never dawned on me that there was race until I was 5 and I went to school. And people began to ask me questions, which I didn't have answers for.
What did they ask you?
Am I a nigger? And I remember thinking, I don't know, I'll ask my parents. So I skipped into the house and said, Daddy and Mommy, am I a nigger? All the time I was growing up, they never described anyone by their race. They never said so-and-so's coming over and they're white or so-and-so's coming over and they're black. It was always by their name and what issue they were working on. So I was kind of trying to figure it out. And I recall being at a friend's house and I saw a big map of the world. And on it, it said Nigeria. And I thought it said Nigeria. And I said, oh, that's why I'm a nigger. I'm from Nigeria. I'm going to go home and ask my parents.
Do you remember your parents' reaction when you asked that question?
Yeah, they just stopped and looked at me kind of horrified. And then they just started talking to each other, and I just went upstairs.
As the safe haven of interracial harmony was thriving inside the house, the world outside was not so kind. Kathleen remembers her father, usually a happy guy, would sometimes look really serious and worried when he answered the phone. Her mom, Marion, says that's because a lot of threatening phone calls were made to the house. Some of them were death threats.
Oh, we were not welcomed on Greek Row, as you may imagine.
We'd go out to go someplace, and they'd get in the car, and we'd start driving, and we'd hear this little tinkle, 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 and get out, and there would be cans tied to the car.
We had bad things happen. They threw rocks at the house and firecrackers.
I remember a march outside of our house.
And little harassments like that every now and then.
One of them sounded quite large. It was a cross, correct? Someone burned a cross on the lawn.
That's correct. That was a year or two after we moved in, and the children were sleeping on a sleeping porch right inside from where the cross was burned. That's kind of a horrific thing to happen.
Actually, Kathleen was awake. She heard something outside. It was dark, but there was enough light to see people setting up a wooden cross in the front yard.
And I looked out and saw people actually digging. And I tried to wake my brother. I said, Ray, there are people in the yard. And he said, just go to sleep. Ray, there are people in the yard. Just go, you know, just basically pushing me off. And I said, Ray, there's a fire in the yard. And he woke up at that point, and we looked out and saw this big blaze. And we ran in to tell my parents about it. So I remember that. I didn't understand why it happened. I had no clue why people would do that to us. I remember, it must have been the next day, I remember standing in the foyer of the house, and the students were there, and everyone was there, and talking quickly and nervously, and I was like under the skirt tails kind of thing, and they were talking about this thing out on the porch. Being curious, I tipped the door open, and I wanted to touch it. So I reached my hand out and touched it. It was gritty. And I couldn't understand why they would be so excited about something so gritty and icky on the porch. And they grabbed me. They said, oh no, she opened the door. And all of these different people, they were all different colors, I remember. They, one hand out of them, just grabbed me back in and shut the door.
Was that the tipping point for you and your husband to get out?
Well, it probably was the beginning of it, yes.
What did your family do after that?
Well, the whole hostility toward us at that time just kind of accumulates, you know, and when you have little children, you worry about stuff like that. So we decided to leave.
Did you lose everything?
Essentially, yes.
The tenants of the house started to get scared. They moved out. The Wests lost their rental income and had to sell. And on top of all of this, Ray lost his job with the YMCA. Kathleen says he was accused of having ties to the Communist Party. The family ended up moving to public housing in Holly Park in South Seattle. Government food filled their cabinets. With three kids to provide for, the family was under a lot of stress. Marion and Ray divorced. But both continued their quest for a more equitable world and kept working for the civil rights movement. Ray was eventually appointed to Seattle's Commission on Fair Housing. He died in 1996. When Kathleen thinks back to the house on Fraternity Row and what her parents did at that time in our nation's history and the price they paid for taking that risk, she's just starting to grasp what a unique experience her parents provided her.
I didn't realize until I was, till probably a year ago, how different that house was compared to most houses even in the world. When you're ostracized at school, when you're different from everybody, when you go to civil rights marches and people glare at you, but your parents do it anyway, you don't realize that you were born into a place that was so forward-thinking, right? Until you reflect as an older person and you look back and you go, oh my goodness, this was so different. I feel so honored to have been born into that.
If you'd like to see the West's home in the U District, well, it was torn down and replaced with a new building. It's a fraternity. Several blocks away from that spot is a brand new apartment building with a food bank on the first floor. It's called the Marion West Apartments. It's just for people who are 18 to 24 years old, people who don't have a lot of money, but who could really benefit from an affordable place to live close to their jobs and school. That's it for the show this week. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson. Special thanks this week goes out to Elena Caldwell, Eula Scott-Bino, and Jasmine Jackson from the Hella Black, Hella Seattle podcast. Thank you so much, ladies. And while you're here, could you finish up the show for me?
Oh, yeah, for sure. We get web help from Dave Nagaris and Parker Miles Blum. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can find Sound Effect on the NPR One app. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And if you'd like to share a story, you can send an email to soundeffect@knkx.org. Sound Effect will be back next week with Broken Heart.
One of the things that when people hear about the project, they think, oh, they're all like breakup poems, but they're not. You know, there's so many different ways your heart can break.
This is 88.5 KNKX.